Hi, everyone. It is great to be here to greet you from the headquarters of one of the world's best capitalized banks in one of the world's best capitalized countries. We are here for this week's live stream event with our CIO experts. As always, if you have questions, please use the slido.com to send them to us. The code is AC7. Today, we are going to update you on latest developments in markets, coronavirus. We're going to talk equities. We're going to talk credit. We're going to talk dollar strength. And you know what I get a lot of feedback. You know, this is a global call. We want to be as specific on recommendations as regulations around the world allow us to be. But of course, in some cases, we can't be as specific as people want about their country or region. So in that case, take a look at our research via e-banking, or please talk to your client advisor. And before I turn this call over to Mark Anderson, I did want to mention, you know, one of the things we keep getting asked is about healthcare in this environment, and what do we see as the best healthcare opportunity. And I have to say that if you think about drug development and the drug development pipeline, for us, one of our long-term themes on oncology remains one of our favorite ways of looking at healthcare. As many of you know, something like one out of two people will die of cancer. The oncology drug pipeline is about a third of the global pharma pipeline. It's already a $150 billion industry that we believe will grow at double digits. And so really that is a way, as money flows into the healthcare space, that is still probably one of the most attractive opportunities. And of course, ultimately it is an area that is involved with, unfortunately, many more tragedies and many more losses of life than what we may see from some of the other things going on today. But with that, I want to turn it over to Mark Anderson to talk about the way we try to think about the world with some scenarios, and the progress that we have made on the pandemic and the official response. So, Mark, please, why don't you update us?
Thanks a lot, Mark. So first of all, let's kick it off on the virus tracking. So I think what's important to realize is that there's obviously a vast amount of data out there, and we're basically trying to triangulate to try to figure out where exactly are we seeing the developments across all the major economies in the world. And some of the things you will see in the media is certainly new cases, have they peaked, what are we seeing around fatality rates, etc. But as we know, a lot of this will also be depending on the degree to which we are testing, as well as the population that we're testing. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to complement some of that data with other data, such as the degree of tests that are coming in positive and negative. Or as you will see in the first slide, something like hospitalizations, which we think is a very accurate picture of what's currently going on, even if it might be slightly delayed compared to new cases that are measured. So here in the first slide, what we're seeing is that Italy, which was really the first European country to put in strict mitigation metrics, we've seen a peak in the new hospitalizations already by end of March. And that's really representative of what we're starting to see now in a broader European context, where we're seeing that a peak is happening already in a majority of countries, and we're starting to debate whether to lift restrictions, and you're seeing the first announcements after Easter in countries such as Austria and Denmark. When we move to the US, and here we see again on the slide that in New York, we're starting to see that the daily hospitalizations have come down very, very recently, but this is an early peak. And on our slide number two, when we have to cut across really the world's major economies, what we're seeing is that in places like Italy and Germany, we can really tick the boxes in terms of peaking on most of the metrics that we're covering right now, versus in places like UK and US, where we're only starting to slowly see improvement, and we're likely to wait another week or two before we're seeing the confirmation of the peak. In terms of the official response that naturally follows, so we think that, as mentioned before, the first European countries are opening up their economy slowly after Easter, most of them probably a few weeks later, and that follows then UK and US by around mid-May.
All right, Mark, now a little while ago, it seems like a million years ago, but we came out with a framework for thinking about these markets around scenarios, upside, downside, central case. Not going to lie to you, a lot of people last week might have said that we were way too optimistic. Now, maybe 7 hours of trading this week on the U.S. markets, maybe we are not looking optimistic enough. If you just think about a point estimate, maybe with some of the data you've given, we moved from a highly, highly uncertain set of outcomes to a highly uncertain set of outcomes. And so I think the scenario framework is still a good way to organize our thinking, but talk a little bit more about, you know, the base case and why we're not taking it up or down from here.
Thanks a lot, Mark. And for those of you online, I'm now referring to slide number 3, where we try to lay out the central case scenarios. And I think what we're seeing is that the market is certainly starting to narrow in on this central case scenario, which, again, might have looked slightly optimistic when we go 2 or 3 weeks back. But in the forecast of the peak of the virus, we really were saying early April for Europe, mid-April for UK and US. This is the type of environment where we think that equity markets, which now have rebounded strongly the last couple of days, are tuning into our central scenario. Equity markets are still suffering from what we think will be a rather dramatic fall in earnings in 2020, but we're looking out to 2021. We are certainly seeing a rebound, which is justifying, I think, around the current levels that we're seeing today. I think what we also did in our analysis was to say that even if we might see a degree of an earnings fall, which could be potentially hurting equities relative to other asset classes, what we're seeing is that on the credit side, where central banks have come in with not only a great deal of liquidity support the well-functioning of markets, but directly also buying higher rated, so investment grade papers in places like the US, is really providing a very strong fundament for spreads to come down from current levels. And what we're seeing across our scenario framework is really that while, again, equity markets have now traded up to be more or less in line with our central scenario, we think that the credit markets are still trailing here somewhere between our central and downside case scenario. And as Fred will outline a little bit later in the call, we're seeing the potential for quite a significant spread tightening around both investment grade, high yield, and emerging market debt in the places where we all have overweight positions in our current tactical asset allocation.
All right. Well, I mean, I understand the point that when you have a framework, you can say, look, on a risk-adjusted basis, credit is more attractive in some respects than equities. But, you know, a lot of people want to invest in equities because they know over the longer term, that's the way that you're going to keep up with inflation, that you're going to hit your return targets. So let's turn to Salida on how we can be invested in equities, but maybe be a little more selective.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Okay, so maybe I'll just cover a little bit of what we think of equities, given the scenarios Mark Anderson just took us through. With better numbers regarding the virus coming out of Spain, Italy, and especially New York, we are hopeful not just for the markets, but for all of us to be closer to our upside scenario. But as Mark mentioned today, we'll focus on our base case scenario, which is still the most probable. Maybe we could break the equity valuations into two components. First, the earnings per share and the price to earnings ratio. So our base case scenario is that earnings will be lower by about 20% this year, and we expect them to start recovering 2021. We also believe that price-to-earning ratios will have to settle at lower levels than what we have seen in pre-virus era, as investors will demand higher premiums to take on equity risks when the volatility is high. So here in the U.S., price-to-earning levels were already at historically high levels after more than a decade of economic and earnings growth. Combining our earnings and price-to-earnings ratio assumptions, our base case target for S&P 500 by the end of the year is 2650. That is roughly where the market is today, suggesting we're fully priced for the environment that we're in. In other words, given the scenario analysis that Mark laid out, we don't see much more significant upside for equities from here unless we take the more optimistic route. Now, that is part of the reason why, as Mark mentioned, we've been recommending credit for our clients who would like to take on more risk, and Fred, I'm sure, will talk much more in detail about that. This does not mean that the recent sudden drop in equities does not provide investors with a chance to add to their positions in certain areas where we believe medium and long-term tailwinds are supportive. And I think first area is high-quality stocks, those names that have low leverage, high cash flows, and sound businesses. The initial drop and the subsequent rebound has been so swift that it has created displacements in the market. When trying to raise cash during such volatile times, some investor types had to resort to selling what is most liquid or highly valued, and that created an opportunity for others. So even though during the rally in the last couple of weeks, indices somewhat have recovered, the really high quality stocks are still almost as beaten down as the rest. So we believe buying high quality stocks with current valuations will yield attractive returns for patient investors. The second area we like are those sectors where secular growth will be a tailwind in the coming decade. We have identified, among others, three key areas where we expect to see exciting trends that will only accelerate due to the current crisis. First is digital transformation. We talked about this in the prior calls as well. Many services that seemed like novelties only a few weeks ago now have become necessities. We're all sitting home, working remotely, ordering online for groceries and other essentials. Our children are being educated online, and we can even have our doctor appointments through telehealth apps. I think we are realizing how convenient and efficient some of these services are, even at a time of exponential demand. And we think there will be an increasing move towards e-commerce, digital services, and infrastructure that makes these possible, such as 5G. Another trend that the current crisis will accelerate is both public and private interest in new therapies. Until recently, I think a lot of healthcare-related discussion around the world has been about affordability. But the current crisis will elevate the discussion, I think, beyond that and into one where we focus on how we can speed up and invest in biotechnology. Some of that will go to fighting potential epidemics, but the main focus is more likely to be in genetic therapies where common illnesses can be treated at a fraction of a cost today, and that will disrupt the current healthcare paradigm. And finally, we also believe investing in the food revolution. It is a smart place to be. Our complex and extensive food chain has been working so far during this crisis, but coming out of the current difficult times where supermarket shelves have been empty, both the general public and the investor community, I think, will look for innovative companies which can increase yields, reduce waste, and deliver food in a safe manner. And I think just as it is the case on the medical innovation side, we believe governments are likely to put in substantial resources to this area as well. So if you see it on the slides, I think it might be slide 8 there, or 9, some of these sectors are more oversold than others. For example, benefits of e-commerce became apparent to most investors right away in the new paradigm, while others, such as 5G plays, took a bigger beating. So these most oversold but secular growth markets represent the highest bang for the buck, in our opinion.
All right. Thank you, Salita. Mark? Thanks, Salita. Now I'm going to turn to Fred. Fred, you know, we heard that from Salita that equity vol is high, and it can be hard for people to put a premium on equities while volatility remains so high. Yet and it's also true that during the great financial crisis, credit led the way out of the downturn, because when the credit spreads started to tighten, that was a signal that the system was working again. But why would I want to buy credit here now when I know that ratings agencies take a while to get their downgrades done and everybody's worried about U.S. high yield because of oil exposure? So make the case for us for credit here.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Hopefully you can all hear me. So
we can hear
I'm
you
on
great.
Slide 11. Perfect, thanks. So yes, we have become constructive on credit, and we basically highlighted three key reasons as to why we've become constructive. And this has already been touched on earlier on the call, but the first one is obviously the policy response. What we've seen from central banks and from governments in terms of stimulus is both unprecedented in size and speed. So you mentioned, Mark, the global financial crisis. I think policymakers have learned a lot from the global financial crisis. And I think the main thing they learned that was when you see a quick sort of tightening of financial conditions, you have to act quickly. And that's essentially what they've done. They've acted incredibly quickly. We've seen the Fed roll out their entire playbook in about 2 weeks, because basically what they're trying to do here by easing financial conditions is avert a further deceleration or contraction in growth. So they're trying to prevent instability and pushing companies into default. So we think what that does is it buys stability and it buys time. So a lot of people ask, well, what does more liquidity, what do interest-free loans actually do, particularly when earnings are being crushed and economic growth is contracting right now? And I guess it doesn't really do much unless those loans become grants. But the main point here is it buys stability and it buys time. And that's perfect for credit investors, because carry is your friend. The second factor, we think, is corporate and even sovereign behavior since pre-COVID has changed 180 degrees. So what we've seen is, particularly on the corporate side, you know, a lot of companies have basically changed their behavior in the sense that they're no longer doing share buybacks, they're cutting dividends, they're preserving cash flow, they're cutting back on CapEx. That's not great for growth going forward, but it is great from a bondholder's perspective, because what it does is it protects creditors. It diverts cash flow to creditors, which is the second reason why we like credit at the moment. And the third reason is the valuation. We've seen a very sharp repricing in credit spreads. And when you think about a credit spread, there's a lot of things embedded in that spread. There's obviously a liquidity premium. And 2 weeks ago, when we saw vicious deleveraging going on in the market, this big demand for cash, liquidity premiums picked up quite significantly. And we would argue that they still exist in a number of credit segments today. But the second one is the implied probability of default embedded in that credit spread. So you asked this question, Mark. We think defaults will be picking up and we are going to see downgrades, but we think what's currently priced in terms of implied cumulative default rates more than compensates you for that risk. Just as an example, and we have this on this chart here, U.S. high yield spreads at the moment basically imply the worst historic default cycle we have ever seen. And we don't think that's going to play out. And it links back to the policy response that I mentioned earlier, that the policy response has been big and fast enough to prevent the worst ever historical default cycle that we've seen.
Well, thank you, Fred, for clearing up some of those questions. And we should probably keep it moving and talk about FX with Tom Fleury. Now, Tom, this year when it started out, nobody thought that King Dollar could ever weaken. And then we woke up one day and the euro had really strengthened versus the dollar. But then, of course, the worst of the COVID crisis came upon us, and we saw that dollar strength return. A lot of people are saying that, you know, that how can they see a different future for the dollar from here? But why don't you talk about the view and how much of this is real valuation, how much of it is flight to liquidity, and when is that going to end, things like that.
Yes, thank you very much, Mark. I hope you can hear me clearly.
Super.
Thank you. So let's go to slide 14, Euro US dollar bringing order into the arguments. As you said, there was a lot of volatility. There was a liquidity squeeze. The transaction demand for dollar was quite strong and over the last couple of weeks, just squeezing the price for the dollar up very strongly. Now let's go a little bit through the arguments and their medium, short-term, longer-term impact on the market, just to get the picture a bit corrected. Global market uncertainty, VIX going higher, so equity volatility, equity prices making people unease and so on. There's certainly an environment where the dollar is gaining versus the euro. And we are hoping that this is more short term, in particular in the way we have seen it over the last couple of weeks, and therefore eventually will fade. But certainly at this moment is one of the arguments why euro dollar is below 110. Euro breakup risk is something which we also think is more short to medium term. It popped up as people were discussing, will Italy ever be able to pay the bills? Will Germany be ready to make compromises? I think the breakup risk, some people think, will stay with us as long as we leave or until this whole thing has broken apart. We are here certainly more optimistic about Europe. It has shown in the periods in the past, whenever exports rising, then these breakup risks are fading, just as the governments are more capable in paying the bills. Then we have another argument which is supportive for the dollar in the current environment, that is the collapse of global trade. I mean, if you're a deficit country as the US is on global trade, so if you're importing more than you export, then also collapse of global trade of demand will also help your import bill, and this is something which is supporting the dollar. At the same time, Europe and others can't play out their strengths, which is their exports. On one thing, we have to make a big question mark, and this is German companies having to pay bills in their dependencies in the factory in the US, or will German companies repatriate money back to Germany? Will US companies repatriate to the US? How is the balance between paying bills and repatriating money? How is this affecting currently the current currency markets we're exploring here? We see here in both directions. The indication is that most people rather repatriate out of US dollars just because they went very long dollars over the last couple of years due to the interesting interest rates. Finally, we come to the factors that in the medium to longer term should weigh on the greenback. Interest rate differentials have come down, though, so there is no exclusive interest rate advantage in the US anymore that should support the euro. For the second half of this year, we are optimistic that the situation around the health and the virus will allow for stronger growth than this year. Last couple of months, this should support the euro. And finally, we have the long-term arguments, purchasing power parity, so the dollar is overvalued. And also something which is worrisome and which we have to explore for the future is how current account and fiscal deficits will weigh on the currencies. Traditionally, the US absorbs a lot of money out of the traditional export countries. But China, oil producers and so on have a problem in with their trade balance, with their income. And for this reason, I see here some dark clouds in the long term on the US dollar. But that's, I think, a long term impact. When we look now at the current situation. Let's go one slide further. The scenarios for major currencies for over the next 6 months. Our expectation is that euro dollar finds back to the level where it was, 113, dollar yen to 104, and so on. Upside scenario would be one where all these currencies are gaining a bit more. Downside is where the dollar just stays stronger, just the way it is currently.
Well, thank you, Tom. And, you know, I think that it is important, something you said, which is you got to separate the current situation from worrying about, you know, how we, the future, where we start thinking about how we pay for everything and things like that. You know, as one of our wise CIOs, Mike Ryan, said, one crisis at a time is a little way the governments are going to deal with this. And we have to take that on board as well. We only have a couple of minutes left, so I want to do a little bit of a speed round to the questions, but I think it's appropriate, since we just spoke to Tom, to just, and some of the questions we have coming in, you know, what is the safest currency to invest in kind of currently, and then, you know, maybe on a, when you start thinking about what comes next?
So to say for currency here, yeah, for home buyers, this is Swiss franc currently. And I think it's fair to say, because the Swiss National Bank does a lot of things to prevent the Swiss franc from appreciating too much, but that's another story. When it comes to where to invest afterwards, I would rather go for the exporters, euro, pound, yen, than emerging markets, because they probably need a bit longer until they catch up.
Okay. All right. Now, maybe just a couple of questions. You know, Mark, do we think that governments are doing enough to keep the economy going through this planned shutdown? How are we thinking about that? How are we going to think about change and reassessing there?
Thanks, Mark. That's certainly a very valid question. I mean, I personally is trying to warm myself up to seeing probably what's going to be the worst data of my professional career here in the second quarter of 2020. And I think certainly the data we've seen from the US labor market in particular, with 10 million people filing for unemployment claims over the last couple of weeks, is getting us a bit of a sense of the drag we're going to see to the economy in the second quarter. As Fred was alluding to before, we've certainly seen a big part of the GFC playbook being rolled out already. I'd say that on the fiscal policy side, we continue to see announcement very recently now from Japan to the tune of 3-4% of GDP to support the economic recovery in Japan. We've seen it in the US, $2 trillion represents 10% of US GDP. There's talk of further packages. So this fiscal stimulus in combination with the central bank's ability to keep companies both liquid and afloat, we think basically provides that stability to allow the economy for rebound from the third quarter and onwards. But those kind of responses are very important, and also in particular holding us away from the defaults that certainly would be at risk without this kind of policy response, to get both the economy back on its feet, but for the same reason, therefore also supporting our view on credit.
Okay, so maybe just time, unfortunately, for one more question. Comes out from some of our many clients today around, you know, dividends and dividend cuts. I want to ask Salid about equities. How do we factor that into the way we're thinking about equities?
Yeah. So our base case expects an earnings dip globally, but not necessarily in dividends. In Europe, we predict dividends to be cut because even before the coronavirus struck, some of those dividends were not sustainable. And same goes for global energy sector, where dividend has to come down regardless. In the US, we're only pricing in a modest dividend cut. However, if banks are pushed by policymakers to suspend dividends to buffer up capital ratios, this is not our base case scenario, but if they do, then this would be a further risk to equity investors and actually a positive for credit investors.
Okay. All right. Well, we've run through the time. We talked a lot about credit and why we think on a risk-adjusted basis that's one of the preferred areas. We talked about particularly some of the long-term themes. I mentioned oncology, and Salita mentioned gene therapy and some of the other ones, and other ways to be a little more selective now in equities. Talked about King Dollar as well. Now, of course, I want to end with, look, if you've had the UBS Wealthway in your front sights this whole time and followed a strategy where you've rebalanced your portfolio through this and stuck to your asset allocations, you're doing pretty well. There's still a wide range of outcomes here, but we have some reasons to be a little more hopeful maybe this week than we were last week. And we are so proud to be here to follow this with you. It is an intense period, but we all know this is something we will remember for the rest of our lives. So please be safe, get enough sleep, wash your hands, and we will see you sometime very soon. Thank you.
UBS Wealthway is an approach incorporating liquidity, longevity, legacy strategies that UBS Financial Services, Inc. and our financial advisors can use to assist clients in exploring and pursuing their wealth management needs and goals over different timeframes. This approach is not a promise or guarantee that wealth or any financial results can or will be achieved. All investments involve the risk of loss, including the risk of loss of the entire investment. Timeframes may vary. Strategies are subject to individual client goals, objectives, and suitability.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.